G'day and welcome to Roaming with Lil. My name is Lil Devereaux. I'm an orientation and mobility specialist based in Melbourne. I'm interested in anything to do with functional vision, orientation and mobility, and the research that helps us to do our job better. I'm currently exploring aspects of workplace health and toxicity, identifying some tools that O&M specialists, guide dog mobility instructors and managers can use to become great employees and to create a community that enables all workers to flourish. A few weeks ago, Tim Dyer, an organisational consultant, explained the value of learning a personality model to know ourselves better and to provide a language to explore and explain otherness. In doing so, we find similarities and perfectly valid differences between ourselves and others, and better ways of working together. Tim and I discussed the Myers-Briggs type indicator, and today I'm talking with Jane Bradley about the Enneagram personality model. The Enneagram symbol dates back to Pythagoras, but the Enneagram personality model was only developed in the mid-20th century, drawing on many different traditions. It resonates for me because it is intricate and multidimensional. I don't feel like it's trying to strip away my individuality and squish me in a box. Rather, I like the way it shows relationships, connections and movement between different types of people, as well as identifying healthy and unhealthy ways of being in the world. Hello, Jane. Welcome.
Hi, Lil. Nice to be here and chat with you.
So tell me a little bit about yourself, Jane.
I am a dog mobility instructor, singer dog instructor. I've worked in our industry for, I guess, 20 odd years now in a range of different roles, but always with that focus on how we create a great working dog for clients.
When did you first come across the Enneagram, Jane?
I guess I'm a bit of a behaviour nerd. Some of us just like learning things. The way I came to this was I was on a course, a behaviour-based psychology course, which was a postgrad. During that course, just lots of unanswered questions kept coming up and me having this curious mind. And my coach and mentor at the time, Thomas, came up one day and just said in this sort of exasperated tone, held up this big blue book, which I now know to be the Wisdom of the Enneagram, held it open at a certain page and just pointed at it and said, "Read that." And walked off, and he'd opened it at my type and he said, go home and read that and stop asking me all these questions and come back tomorrow and we'll talk about it. So that's what I did, and that was my first introduction to the Wisdom of the Enneagram.
Did you know any other personality models before you came to the Enneagram?
Yeah, I did. I knew DISC profile, I knew the Myers-Briggs 360 feedback models, a whole heap of schema, because that's just the type of thing that interests me. Models, mathematical models, personality models, behavior models, how they function, what makes us human, you know, where does the cross section across all the species line, how do the laws of learning work? Yeah, that's just my thing.
When you read about the Enneagram, how did you find this particular model different to the others that you'd learned about?
Well, the funny thing was Thomas said to me, when you read it, the way you'll know that you've got it right is you'll read that and you'll go, "Huh, that's not me at all." And he said there'll be bits in it that almost sting. He says that's how you know you've got the appropriate type. And I said, well, I didn't just read my type. I went and read all the other types and all the subcategories and everything. And he said, well, that's just classic for your personality type. So I thought, well, there must be something in this. I'll go back and read it again. So I did. I guess the way it's a little bit different, it's really about having that flexibility across the personality models. So you don't just go, oh, you know, I'm MBTI type X, therefore I must always be this way. So it's about learning the insight from the model and that it's just a frame and learning to flex across the disciplines. So where this really struck a chord with myself was it's more of a, when you look at the diagram, it's more of a, almost like a DNA helix. It goes up and down, flexes across different areas, and it can be traced back to Pythagoras, apparently. It's really quite interesting. So there's almost an art and a science to this model, which I find really interesting. And there's a spiritual component to it which is, I guess, quite unique to this model.
Let's go through each of the nine types briefly. I know that the Enneagram model prefers to refer to these types by number because language can have such different implications for people. So when we're using language to define these types, let's hold it a bit loosely because any of these types has its kind of shiny side and its shadow side. And if one word doesn't work, then perhaps we can find other words.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah.
So number one, the perfectionist, they save the whales. Things are black and white.
Yeah, they are black and white. That's very true.
The rules are very clear.
They are. Often found out, I would imagine, in courts of law, I think places like that. Yeah, they're rational and idealistic type of people, principled, purposeful, self-controlled and perfectionistic. And the message from their superego is you're good or okay if you do what is right. They have a mission in life and they often feel they have to justify their actions to themselves and others as well, which means they spend a lot of time thinking about consequences.
Mm.
They're the ones who are trying to be good kids.
Keep everyone happy, tick all the boxes.
Yeah. Yeah, must do this, should do that.
There's a lot of should, must, ought language.
Yeah. Yeah, modal operators of, yeah, necessity. So somebody else is telling you that you should do this. So, yeah, that mindset.
And I feel that ones hold the weight of their world on their shoulders sometimes because that burden of having to get it right is terribly heavy. There's not a lot of softness around that.
Yeah, must be quite exhausting, yeah. If the one has the nine wing, they become the idealist, and in a healthy zone, examples of those people would be Plato, Gandhi. People with a two wing become healthy advocates who blend their quest for ideals with empathy and compassion. So they're where you can stretch on either side of your oneness.
So let's talk twos, the helper.
I think many of us will know twos. This is a real generalization, but I always feel like everybody's got an auntie two in the family, you know, the one that runs around and puts things into place and helps and organizes. And these people find it incredibly important to assist others. They see their sense of worth and value in the way that they assist or develop or support other people.
The curious thing I find about twos is that they can often do that without insight. So the magic button is to hear, I have a problem. And the two will kick into action to resolve that need or that problem almost without thought of the cost to themselves. They can actually lose a sense of identity in the middle of that because their identity comes from being the helper.
You sometimes hear this sort of overwhelmed, take on too much and it's, you know, people become a little bit overwhelmed with those things. But, yeah, in that space between I need help and the two jumping in to help, there's the stimulus response, there's a space. And I guess the two's goal is to learn not to just jump into that space.
And the dark side of the twos is that they can be quite manipulative.
Look, I believe so. I hadn't really experienced this, but, they can become either, I guess, the servant type or a people pleaser is the other one, or the ones that they fear they're driving their people away and then they, you know, they rationalise their behaviour by keeping everybody a little bit closer and a little bit controlling, I think, at times.
Mm. And three, the performer.
They are always looking smart, the motivator, the role model. A bit of status seeking always looks super, super smart.
The appearance of success
is
very important to threes, isn't it?
Yeah, super important. Mm. Yeah.
So it's about looking good. It's about getting the job done quickly and efficiently.
Yeah.
It's about productivity and output. Often these are quite, the performer, it's not necessarily about theatre, but often these people are front men or women. Happy to be in the limelight.
Put on a good show.
I think both the strength and the shadow side of the performer, the three, is that chameleon element. So it's about being able to move into a group and do what's needed to fit in with that particular group. And a person who's really skilled at doing that is very socially flexible. But on the other hand, can leave you wondering, who is the real you?
Yeah, who is this person? Yeah, the three with the two in the charmer, the talk show host, you know, the gregarious personality type. And the other side of that, they can be the professional, you know, super professional, work the room, absolutely fantastic. But perhaps you do, yeah, who are they really? Who are the three?
I think the other thing about the threes that I know is that they're really good at the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. So you don't have to get things perfect. You can get 80% of the job done and that can be near enough. And then you move on to the next thing. Everything doesn't have to be top quality. It just has to be finished. Bang, yeah. Move on.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And I remember somebody I know quite well said to me once, oh, P's make degrees, that as in passes make degrees. I just never thought of that. It was kind of a really interesting concept to me, but that was okay for the three. You know, P's make degrees, get the job done, we get the degree, we get the bit of paper and we move on, and we've been successful. So
yeah, fours, the tragic romantic.
My mentor Thomas also told me the fours are attracted to my personality type, so I found that quite interesting. You know, very intense, introspective, incredibly artistic, quite prolific. I would imagine Nick Cave would be a really good example of a four.
Possibly. A sense of drama.
Yeah, the drama. Absolutely. Yeah.
So fours are not scared of their emotions. They're probably the least scared of their emotions of all the personality types, I reckon.
Yeah, there's a beautiful quote from Proust here. Happiness is beneficial for the body, but it is grief that develops the power of the mind.
The angst of it all.
Yeah, the tragic victim and the special one, you know, melancholy. Mm.
That's right. So fours, they hate being mainstream. They hate being ordinary. They love to be special, a little bit misunderstood.
The artist,
a little bit different to everyone else. Yeah. They don't like to be commonplace.
Incredibly creative.
Fives.
I would say my dad is a five, actually.
Fives are the thinkers.
The investigators. Deeply thoughtful. And introspective, I guess.
Possibly the most introverted of all the personality types, because if in doubt, they just go into a cave to dig for more information and understand things in very great depth.
As you're saying, I'm visualising my dad, who tootles off into his computer room, as he calls it, and just starts investigating things and writing programs and looking up things and innovating things and thinking deeply about things.
They don't have a scattergun approach to learning and knowledge. It's very deep and very systematic. And when they know about something, they become the subject matter experts.
Yeah. I don't think they think they are, but they are. They really are.
Well, it might be easy to assume, if we're all that bit narcissistic, that if I know it this well, everyone else must as well.
I've heard my dad say exactly that. He says, oh, I thought everybody knew about this. That's exactly what he says.
Sixes, the loyalist.
When we think about organisations, I think military organisations, the army, I would imagine that would be a six type organisation.
My mum is a loyalist. In fact, I've got a number of them in my family. They're very dutiful.
Yeah, true believers, the troubleshooters, traditionalists, very stoic and stalwart.
They do like routines and predictability, and they're a bit fearful of change, but they're incredibly good at hanging their hat on a particular system, a belief system, a structure, and sticking with that.
Yeah, they're so loyal, they don't want to be left abandoned or left without that support system, and it can be a failure of self-confidence that the support system is everything. Yeah, they're hard workers, they plod along. They're actually quite anxious, even though you wouldn't perceive it. So I think of some sixes that I know, like the swan metaphor, where the swan's sort of gliding along gracefully on the water, but the feet are paddling away like crazy underneath to keep things afloat and looking stable. So
So there's a lot invested in keeping the system ticking over.
yeah, committed, security conscious, engaging, suspicious. They're quite suspicious too.
They are, because there's, on the one hand, this loyalty to a higher authority, whatever that authority is, but I guess it gives them the inside scoop, and they can be a little bit cynical and suspicious even while they belong. So there is an element in the Sixes, I know, of proclaiming the rules of the system that they've ascribed their loyalty to, while at the same time being a bit naughty and breaking the rules sometimes, like sneaking out and doing what you like doing COVID, staying out for an hour longer than your apportioned exercise.
Goodness. And they might say things like, you know, I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't. Yeah, they can become very paranoid at times, the Sixes.
But at the same time, if you need someone in your corner, they're just there.
Yeah, many, many good qualities.
They hold the tiller steady so that we're not storm-tossed.
Yeah, they're not all charging off.
Now the Seven, Jane.
Yes.
There are many words for the Seven. The Epicurean.
Spontaneous. Versatile. The Energizer. Scattered. My family call me the pain in the backside.
The Enthusiast.
The Enthusiast, yeah.
Sevens are eclectic. They're interested in everything in life. Greed is good. If it was good the first time, let's have more. Let's do it again. Why stop at one?
Yeah. Most likely to shout again.
More.
Gluttony is one of the vices of the Seven. Appetite for experience and information and knowledge and more.
More is definitely better. Fun. But the shadow side is that a very eclectic Seven can be spread so thin across so many different interests that they never actually tap in and learn or know anything in depth. Can be quite superficial party people and run away from the discipline of going deeper.
Yeah, that I would say the discipline and the closure, actually, of, because there's so many possibilities, you know, and projects and things to do, that the actual, the discipline of, for example, project management or closure or finalising the project.
Because
has to be learned.
The tragedy of deciding for one thing is that you miss out on all the other things that were options. If you just hold all of those options open for as long as possible, it's as if you get to do them all.
I think FOMO was designed for Sevens, actually.
Yeah, fear of missing out, that's it.
People will make comments about jack of all trades, master of none. So yep. The Sevens learning is really, as you say, to really explore in depth and obtain the true mastery.
Rather than being a fly by night. Yep.
Yeah, or conceived fly by night, yeah.
How about eights? The boss.
You love a good eight, actually. The challenger, the leader, the protector, the entrepreneur, the maverick quite often. Not afraid to shake things up and do things differently. The rock. Yeah. Adult mindset at an early age, always quite serious.
I think of eights as people who understand power and see power dynamics at a glance. They can walk into a room and just with one glance in the room, know where the power sits, know how to work with it. They're not scared of confrontation or conflict, happy to state their case because it is what it is. It's not about right or wrong. It's just about, oh, stop messing around. Just get on with it.
Yeah.
The flip side of the eights that I love is that they're passionately concerned about the underdog.
The champion and the bear, you know, they'll sort of support their people to the death. You know, they really, really do. Some of my very good friends are eights, and I call them up when I want an opinion on something, and because I know they're just going to give it to me straight, whether I want to hear it or not.
They won't fluff around in polite niceties.
No. And I'll say, what do you think about this? And you just sort of get it with both barrels. So, and you can, I think you can come away a little bit bruised sometimes with the interactions with the eights, but that's the beauty of them. You know, they're not afraid of those things. And quite topical at the minute because Donald Trump is typed as an eight, actually.
So they understand power and how to use it whether unwisely or wisely.
They can be ruthless, dictatorial, megalomaniacs, and terrorizing.
At the unhealthy end of things.
The unhealthy end. At the healthy end, self-reliant, confident, strong, heroic.
In that Greek hero model, come and rescue everyone. The nines, the mediator.
The peacemakers and receptive and agreeable and reassuring. They do like peace. The ones I know are all rather introverted. They learn to cope by dissociating from threatening things or scary things or going off to their little world.
And my favourite saying about the nines is, why stand when you can sit? Why sit when you can lie down? They're very restful people to be with.
They're sort of creating interesting things and interesting mind models and often very good at coaching and listening, good listeners.
Thoughtful. They get alongside people quite well, don't they? They're supportive people. And the flip side of nines is that they can get so agreeable with everyone else that they lose sight of who they are and what they want to achieve.
Yeah, I think they worry about having the peace disrupted.
Don't like to make waves.
Peace is important. Worry about, I guess, being overwhelmed with the need to respond.
The fitting in-ness.
Yeah, perhaps, you know, stop being so agreeable.
Can you give me some attitude here?
Yeah, yeah. Very unhealthy nines are unable to face reality at all.
A nine, when they're not healthy, they become a little bit fetal, a little bit shut away and
listless
and unable to engage with people.
Yeah.
And when they're healthier, there's a deliciously stubborn streak to nines as well. So you're going along on an even keel and there's not a lot of pushback or attitude, and then suddenly, wham!
Yeah.
Where did all that attitude come from? Yeah, and there'll be a particular issue or an agenda that they're just not happy about being compliant.
Yeah, and it's all about having the healing, positive vision of life, and they don't want things to disrupt that. So interesting characters.
So we've got nine different personality types in the Enneagram arranged around a circle. And three of them are connected by a triangle, 3, 6, 9, and the others are connected with a curious pattern of lines that is very specific to the Enneagram model. So with each of those nine personality types, what's the deal with the lines?
The lines are about where you intersect with the people or the personality types on each side of you. So say, for example, you are a one. You have a wing on each side of you where you connect to the two or the nine on the other side, and the lines that go across, it's about being healthy and unhealthy, so that when you're operating in a very healthy state and you're in your growth mindset, that you can flex to a different area on the model. And when you're perhaps in an unhealthy state, not feeling good, and the challenges of the world are upon you, you may perform in this unhealthy capacity, which you will revert to a different type on the model.
So instead of people feeling like they're locked into a particular personality type, there's actually directions of growth and unhealth?
Yeah, it's called healthy and unhealthy, but I've learned to think of it as expansion and contraction almost, or expansion into different areas.
So Thomas picked you straight off. He knew what type you were. What are the other ways that someone can learn where they fit on the Enneagram personality model?
Well, you can do online personality typing just the way you can with anything else. You can read all about it in the big blue book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, which is fantastic. And there's also very in-depth courses where you can go and study the model. I was told by Thomas and the person who is his mentor, the best way to do it is to get somebody who actually really has been trained to type you. But I guess the quick and dirty way is just go online, have a go.
Whenever I've talked about Enneagram with people and they want to know where they fit, we can usually eliminate 4 or 5 out of the 9 personality types just by going, no, definitely not. Definitely not, and narrow it down to a few others, and then look at the wings either side of the personality types to see whether there are connections that way or those directions of health integration versus unhealth, disintegration, to see what you do when you're in holiday mode or when you're really, really stressed, because that can help to narrow down the options of where you fit on the model too.
Yeah, I think the stress area is often a very good indicator.
Have you married a 7, Jane?
No. I've married an 8 with a 7 wing, so that's where we connect. So my husband's a teacher and backs the kids to the hilt, but also is known as the enforcer at work, the disciplinarian, the authoritarian, the year 10 coordinator, rounds up the teenage boys and sort of, this is very, I guess, very black and white with them, but equally very much has their back, yeah.
Mm. So kind, but definitely able to offer direction, not leave them fumbling, unsure.
Yeah. Firm but fair, yeah.
Firm but fair. So you've used the Enneagram to understand yourself. You've used the Enneagram to understand a little bit more about your husband and how he operates. How about people at work? Do you find yourself looking at people during meetings and going, ooh, I bet you're a 3 or I bet you're a 5?
Yeah, I do. So I do. So, again, my mentor, Thomas, and part of the training course that I did was around really put your own oxygen mask on first. So learn to manage yourself, your behaviour, your emotions, how you can flex to meet other people. Then you gain mutually agreeable outcomes and objectives, and you will get more done better and faster together is what I'm trying to say. So, yeah, I do a lot of listening, observing, listen, ask strategic questions, watching people. As a behaviorist, I am a watcher. I listen to language. Rather than reacting, just try and work out where are the mutual connection points where we can work together really effectively in the pursuit of our common goals. So that's the way I try and apply the Enneagram in my workplace.
Now, you've been reading a book called Getting Your Boss's Number.
I have.
Tell me about that.
I'm in a position where I do work with a lot of people, and I've been in leadership roles for a number of years. So in classic 7 style, I just turned straight to the bit about myself. You know, I am invested in this because I thought anybody that works with me or around me, it's really important to know yourself and know your own strengths and weaknesses and know how you might actually be irritating the hell out of all the people that you work with. So what do you need to work on yourself? So I've been reading this book. One of the bits you mentioned earlier about lack of staying power. It's not uncommon for 7s to lack the staying power to complete a long-term project. So one of my classic things is people sort of roll their eyes when I say, I've had an idea. So they've got this conditioned response now, because I know I'll just come up with 15 ridiculous ideas probably, and they just sort of roll their eyes and they say things like, what are you doing now? This sort of quite irritated tone. So when I hear that, I usually think, well, I need to wind it back a bit on the 7 ways.
You overwhelm people with your ideas.
Yeah, I can do. And what I've learned is that people think the ideas are a reality, that was the direction that we wanted to go in as the organisation or the team, or that's what we were going to do, and it's locked in. But it was just talking about possibility for myself. So I've learned to preface it, and then I've had an idea, what would you think about this? And then put it to test in a team meeting. And then if it's all agreed and everyone thinks that's a great idea, actually develop a project timeline and how we're going to run it and how we're going to close it out. When I see something happening that I think, oh, that's a little bit unusual or out of character, or somebody seems to be a little bit worked up, I should say, agitated, you know, I've learned to think, what's the function of the behaviour? What is it about that? And either what do they want, or what is it that's maybe pressing the button on that? Perhaps people think a client hasn't been treated fairly, for example. That wasn't fair. So you quite often get a lot of values-based language when you see this. And it can sort of fit within the personality type. So the 8, if the 8 feels that perhaps somebody's been upsetting their people, be mindful, you know, the wrath of the 8 will know no bounds, because they have this loyalty and defensive and protective mechanism towards their people.
The eight being the boss, the ones that know power.
Some other examples, perhaps the five, another personality type might appear and be feeling very strongly, lots of feelings and conversation. The five might just say, I just want the objective information. Give me the facts. So I want to work out what is going on around this. And then the other personality type might think, oh, gosh, they're so unfeeling. They're cold. They have no heart. They don't care. Those kind of behavior conflicts can occur.
I think an interesting thing about a five is because they like to go into things very deeply and think very deeply, it can take a while. It can be hard to get a straight answer from a five on the spot. And you need to ask a question, then allow some pondering time and come back for the answer tomorrow or next week.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a really good answer and you'll probably just get it once. The conversation will only happen once.
Yeah.
And that's it in a nutshell, because the fives declare what they think after due consideration. They don't blather while they're thinking it through.
And they'll say things like, you know, don't rush me, or, yeah, I'll get back to you. So I've learned in the engagement with fives, I'll send them the information in an email. I'll give them time and I'll say, do you have time to chat with me about this? I let them set the day and then I go back and have a listen. Yeah. So learning to work effectively with those different types of people is really useful.
And if someone's in a dark place, how is the Enneagram useful?
Well, you know, I think it's been interesting over the past 6-7 months, particularly for those of us that live in Victoria and Melbourne, because we've been put into a completely different lifestyle, workspace. Everything has really changed for us. So I think that part of being a responsible human is accepting that people sometimes will be up and sometimes will be down, and it's been quite challenging for people with the feelings of isolation. And I guess just trying to get that, we call it homeostasis, what's normal? What's normal for that person? It's my responsibility, I feel, to look out for my colleagues and how are they going, and are they having a day when they're really struggling? And is, you know, it's all part of the are you okay thing, isn't it? How are you going? Are you having a difficult time? And if there's a consistency around that, what can I do in my interactions? Is it a crisis point where, you know, we would direct people to the workplace counselling and additional support and structures from their colleagues and their peers and their managers? Or perhaps that's just the way they are in the world. So my role in that place is to ask those strategic questions about, you know, but just assist people with some different strategies when they may be locked into one answer. So, yeah, that's the way I've learned to be. Listen, ask strategic questions, ask process-orientated questions, help people achieve their objective. I think that's my job.
When I'm working with people who seem to be in a dark place, I find that if I understand where they fit on the Enneagram, then it's equally helpful to look at what the ordinary direction of health or integration or growth would be for that person, and look for opportunities in the workplace that encourage that direction. So if a seven is being very scatty and scattered and unable to settle into what they're doing, and they're not happy, they're not in a happy place with that, then the direction of health for a seven is towards a five. So it's to choose something and go into it deeply and do it well. So I might be looking at a project that seven might be able to sink their teeth into that's interesting enough to begin, but then have some clear deadlines built into that of accountability that helps that seven kind of structure their achievement, their success, and they're going into depth in their knowledge.
We would call that antecedent arrangement. So set up the environment for success.
About finding the right opportunities in the person's environment to allow them to flourish.
Yeah, so that's a really good point that you're raising.
I feel like the Enneagram is a trickier personality model to understand because it is incredibly complex, but that very complexity makes it much richer. It feels less like it places people firmly in a box and puts the lid on and tries to contain them, because there is this opportunity to move when healthy from one place to another, or behave more like another personality type when you're in a less healthy place.
I guess the other personality type models like MBTI, you know, there's the 16 characteristics and with the Enneagram there's less, there's the 9, but it's that behavioral flexibility between each type, which I think took some learning for me to understand that. It is very different. And I think the other thing around it is there's a concept of spirituality within this model, which was a little bit unusual for me outside my experience with religious models, having grown up in a very Catholic family, very sort of traditional family. It was just unusual to me to learn this model and think about spirituality and what does that mean and how does that apply to the way I go about things. And how does this apply in the modern world? It can be a little bit confronting for people when you start talking, and it can sound like guru nonsense, you know, some of this stuff.
I find Australians very wary of conversations about religion or spirituality or anything like that. And it's almost like our existence gets stripped away to the practicalities, and we've lost a language for mystery. Like it's not cool to believe.
Yeah, I think that there's a new focus on well-being, mindfulness.
Which, of course, comes out of the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, I think you're right. People have lost the language for spirituality. What does that mean? Where's the ritual, for example, when someone that you love does die, but you're not a religious person and you don't want a religious type, you know, conventionally religious type ceremony? Or how do people pledge themselves to each other these days if they don't want to go to a traditional church ceremony, for example? So where are those time-honoured rituals?
I don't know that we spend enough time simmering on those broader, deeper layers of meaning around ritual, wisdom, unanswered questions. Mm. And I guess they're the things that we're referring to when we look at something like the Enneagram, holding within it a space for spirituality, for a spiritual life.
Yeah, there's an ambiguity, I think, about some of those things that's not helpful to people.
I suppose each of the personality types in the Enneagram find ways to sit with uncertainty and to hold that, and some move on from uncertainty really quickly and just want to take action, and other people are far more comfortable with having unanswered questions in their lives.
I was very fortunate last year. I went to a number of conferences, and one of the themes of the conferences I went to was learn to be comfortable with cognitive dissonance. So actually being able to sit and hold and listen to different perspectives that you might really oppose and not believe in, but the actual discipline of being able to sit there, listen to the language, listen to the words, listen to the opposing viewpoint, listen to the counterpoint in the argument without actually responding in an inflammatory or, I don't know, otherwise way. It's a real discipline. It's a big takeaway for me, I think, for in 2019, the huge learning point that I'm trying to bring to everything I do.
Mm. Yeah. Just to put a little pause on your own responses so that you make sure that you hear other people's contribution more fully.
Yeah, and be aware of any sort of hot spots or trigger points, or it could be something completely radical that we wouldn't agree with as humans, but just actually the discipline of learning to listen and examine those ideas has been extremely useful.
Mm. Well, there you have it, Jane. The Enneagram model is a great tool for understanding ourselves and other people that we live with and that we work with, our kids, our managers, organisations and countries.
Maybe our pets.
All kinds of places that we can go with the Enneagram. So for those who haven't met the Enneagram yet, it's worth probably Googling the model and seeing what it looks like. Find out where you sit yourself and the places that it might be able to help you become more insightful about yourself and learn more about the others that you live and work with.
Yeah, it's the, almost like the great nature-nurture debate, isn't it? The analytics versus the holistic. It really
helps bring into focus and examine all those models. It's incredibly useful.
Jane, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure, Lil. Thank you so much. Keep sevening.
Thanks to Jane Bradley for joining me today. You can find a summary of our conversation about the Enneagram, along with some of the resources Jane referred to, in the PowerPoint on my website, www.lildeverall.net. The Enneagram personality model gives us plenty to ponder in relation to workplace health as we keep roaming.